right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, November 2nd, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday, everyone. It is a warmer 55 degrees and just at the tail end of the last soggy 24 hours here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off on Tuesday? We had guest Ira Pastor, CEO of BioQuark, on this show talking about biologics and regenerative medicine and some of the things that they are doing. I found that conversation very interesting because Ira actually went to school for pharmacy and sees exactly what's going on in the laboratory. So it was neat to have someone who really knew what was going on to speak to about this. So to stay in lines with the future of not only medicine, but everything in general, and how things are going with humanity, I ran across a treat yesterday. It was off of live stream, streamed on October 13th, 2017. It was hosted by the Abundance 360 group that is chaired by Peter Diamandis, who is the founder of the XPRIZE, and he is also the co-founder of Singularity University with Ray Kurzweil. In this interview, in this Abundance 360 community, he brings together 360 entrepreneurs, executives, and investors committed to transforming their success into significance for the 21st century. And he is encouraging these people to invest in the takeover of the human race. We've talked about that before. And I think this interview slash discussion that we're going to listen to here in a few minutes is going to kind of illustrate what I'm talking about. They discuss through the next 25 to 28 years what they see is coming and how things are going to play out for humanity and the integration of humanity with these new cutting-edge technologies. And you're going to find out that just about everything they talk about, we have discussed on the show. And the fact that it's coming out of the mouth of Kurzweil is the scariest part, because it is a lot of his doing and a lot of his forethought that is pushing this stuff forward. One of the things that I was reading about is some of Peter Diamandis's history, and he was involved in a lot of the commercialization of space with that XPRIZE. He put out a call for a $10 million prize for anyone who could make it to, I don't remember if it was upper or lower Earth orbit, within a two-week period, and it garnered all kinds of interest. And I think one of the first winning rockets was funded by Paul Allen of the Allen Brain Institute that we read about last week, where they just digitized or took the digitization of neurons and made a 3D representation of the brain online for study. But in one of the stories that I was reading, Peter Diamandis met in June of 2001 with Elon Musk and another individual named Adeo Risi. And Risi had been Musk's college roommate, but they discussed at that very first meeting not only entrepreneurs wanting to go to space, but also Musk talked to Diamandis about his whole plan to go to Mars and how they could capitalize upon that. They also talked about mining asteroids and that type of thing. So it's interesting to note that a lot of this that is coming forward was cooked up by a lot of these tech billionaires and is being foisted upon us. And I want to talk tomorrow again about dopamine and some of the effects that it causes on the brain, some of the research that I found recently. And listen to Kurzweil, because he even mentions the Mars mission somewhere in here in regards to that would be the time of making sure we all had brain implants. And he talks about nanobots in your blood and all the good Kurzweilian things that we have discussed before. So what I've done is cut this interview into this show, and it should be coming up here any second. I hope you guys enjoy, and we will discuss this at length tomorrow.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. We have folks here from 50 countries joining my dear friend Ray Kurzweil. my co-founder of Singularity University, and myself for 90 minutes of fun conversation, pal.
Sounds great.
We're going to talk about the next, I'd like to talk about the time frame of the next 25 years, the countdown to the singularity, all the exponential technologies. We have amazing questions that you've given us. Let me just
25 does not get us to the singularity.
Well, it gets us close.
It's 28.
It gets us close. I mean, believe me, at 25, I'm going to be like just, it's going to be magic. Let me welcome the Abundance Digital community. Welcome to my community members. An honor and a pleasure to have you here with me. Welcome to the Singularity University community and to Futurism. All of you who are Futurism fans like I am, welcome and a pleasure to have you guys here. So let me tell you the format, introduce myself, then properly introduce Ray Kurzweil. So the format is Ray and I are going to chat for about 30 minutes. I have, you know, even though I get to see you all the time, I have a lot of questions to ask you that I'd like to ask for my community members. Then we'll actually go into a Q&A with you and, you know, ask us and we'll do our best to answer your hardest questions. I like to think about dangerous ideas because of the magnitude of what we're playing with. So very quickly, my background is a serial entrepreneur of now 19 companies focused in space and longevity and grand challenges, the author of two New York Times bestsellers, Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. The name came from Ray and also Bold, How to Go Big, Create Wealth, and Impact the World. Very proud to be the co-founder of Singularity University, the executive chairman of the XPRIZE Foundation, and amazing companies like Human Longevity, Cellularity, Planetary Resources. And I love, 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 and part of my massively transformative purpose is helping entrepreneurs like you really figure out how to go big and impact the world. So we'll be talking more about those things. Let me do a proper introduction of Ray, who's got one of the most awesome bios that I know. I actually have this probably memorized, pal. Since we've had a chance to do so many gigs together, but let me just take a second and read it. So Ray Kurzweil is one of the world's leading inventors, thinkers, and futurists. He has a 30-year track record of accurate predictions. If you go to Wikipedia, I think your prediction rate is like 86%, 87%?
86% of the 147 predictions I made in the 1990s about 2009 were correct.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. You've been called the relentless genius by the Wall Street Journal, the ultimate thinking machine by Forbes. You were selected one of the top entrepreneurs by Inc. magazine, described as the rightful heir to Thomas Edison, not too shabby. PBS selected you as one of the 16 revolutionaries who made America. Ray was the principal inventor of the first CCD flatbed scanner, the first OmniFont optical character recognition, the first print-to-speech reading machine for the blind, the first text-to-speech synthesizer. There's a pattern here. There's the first music synthesizer capable of recreating the grand piano and other orchestral instruments, and the first commercially marketed large vocabulary speech recognition. Among your many honors, you've received the Grammy Award for Outstanding Achievements in Music Technology. You're the recipient of the National Medal of Technology, inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame. You hold 21 honorary doctorates. That's not too shabby. And been honored by three U.S. presidents. You've written 5 national bestsellers, including New York Times bestsellers, The Singularity is Near, which I loved and became the basis, really, for us collaborating and launching Singularity University. You're also written How to Create a Mind. We're here at Google headquarters recording this. This is you actually got a day job. Your first day job.
I do. It's my first job. It's going pretty well.
Yeah, it's going pretty good. And you're director of engineering here at Google, and you head up a team. Actually, it's been an exponentially growing team, developing machine intelligence and natural language processing understanding. You're on my board at the XPRIZE Foundation, and most importantly for me, you're the co-founder and chancellor of Singularity University.
That's been great.
Yeah, and a member of the Abundance 360 team, and you'll be at Abundance 360 this coming January. We're going to have a lot of fun.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah, we talk about the collision of artificial general intelligence, nanotechnology, and brain-computer interface. I mean...
Yeah, I think the word general is not needed.
Okay.
That was an inherent criticism by people that felt that AI was not actually working on AI. But I actually think we'll get to general intelligence by mastering all of these narrow fields, and the narrow skills are getting broader and broader until there really won't be a difference between artificial and natural intelligence. But it's not an alien invasion of AI from Mars. We're gonna
build it ourselves.
Well, we're gonna make ourselves smarter by merging with them.
So we'll talk about that. A lot of questions about when we're going to connect our neocortex to the cloud. Also, some questions about, is there alien life out there? I know you and I have a debate about that, so we might talk about that a little downstream. You know, one of the things I've been looking at is that the rate of accelerating change is actually accelerating in many ways. And there are interesting factors driving that. And what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the law of accelerating returns is that the price, performance, and capacity of information technology grows exponentially, not linearly. That sounds simple. I'm sure this audience is aware of the difference between linear and exponential growth, but it's quite profound. That's behind the disruption that we're seeing. And people think linearly, and the critics who are diminishing of these viewpoints just think it's obvious things will be linear. The 7 years through the Genome Project, we did 1%. So it was obvious it was going to take 700 years.
to sequence the human genome, right.
Right. But in fact, it continued doubling every year when it's finished 7 years later. That's continued since the end of the Genome Project. You're involved.
Yeah,
my
company,
HLI,
we're sequencing a genome now for $1,000 in half a day.
Yeah, so that's actually a million-fold improvement since the one we finished in 2003, which cost $1 billion.
Yeah.
And every other aspect is growing exponentially. But the rate of exponential growth, the exponent, has increased slowly. It took us 3 years to double the price performance of computation in 1900, 2 years in 1950, 12 months in 2000, it's now down 11 months. So there's a slow second exponent. But one level of exponential growth is good enough. That exponential growth is leading to an increase in the paradigm shift rate.
Yeah. Let's talk about paradigm shift rate, because it's not just the acceleration of tech, especially for entrepreneurs, it's new business models.
Yeah.
And it's the convergence of technologies that make things interesting.
You know, hundreds of years ago, your grandparents lived the same lives you did, and you expected correctly that your grandchildren would do the same. That began to be disrupted around 1800, starting in the textile industry in England, when all these machines came along, business models were uprooted from the technology. This guild of weavers that had passed down this business model of having a family business of weaving cloth was suddenly disrupted. And it led to a perception, oh my goodness, all employment's going to go away, which in fact it did, but we invented new jobs. How many jobs circa 1900 exist today? So we have eliminated all human employment several times, and yet we nonetheless have actually more people as a percentage of the population working today than ever before. Jobs pay 11 times as much in constant dollars per hour than they did a century ago. So we can talk more about employment. But yes, business models are based on the current technology. They're all technology-based. And as the technology changes, the business models change.
So I'm thinking about the acceleration that we're about to go from. We have about 3.8 billion people connected on the planet today. And that will be within the next decade with Loon, with SpaceX, with OneWeb.
So that was 2 billion just a couple of years
ago. Yeah, it was 1.8 billion in 2010, 3.8 now. And we'll probably hit 8 billion connected people. And so, but these 4 billion new minds are not coming online like you and I did at 9600 baud at AOL. They're coming online with a gigabit. And so I think one of the things that's going to accelerate speed of acceleration is more brains using more tech.
Yeah, more brains and more powerful tools and more access to information. So this gal who buys a smartphone for $75 in Africa has access to all of human knowledge and extremely powerful information tools. Which, by the way, counts as zero economic activity because it's all free.
The economics are broken today, aren't they?
Yeah. So, I mean, I had an on-stage dialogue with Christine Lagarde, head of the International Monetary Fund, at their annual meeting, and she said, yes, it's amazing what you can do with digital technology, but how come we don't see any gains in productivity? And I said, that's because you put it in the numerator and the denominator. So that $75 smartphone is $75 of economic activity, despite the fact that it's literally $1 trillion of computation and communication circa 1965, $1 billion circa 1980, and has millions of dollars of free information apps, like an encyclopedia that's much better than the one I saved up for years as a teenager in Dubai. And all that counts for nothing.
Yeah.
So we basically don't count it. And then a point that you've made substantially, she said, okay, it's true, the digital world's amazing, you can do all these fantastic things, but you can't eat information technology, you can't wear it, you can't live in it. So all that's going to change as well. Energy, buildings, clothes printed out by 3D printers, food and from vertical agriculture, these are all going to become information technologies. And subject to the very profound deflation rate of information technology, and everyone wonders why there isn't inflation when there's all these inflationary pressures, it's because information technology is deflationary.
Yeah.
I can get the same computation, communication, genetic sequencing I could a year ago today for half the price. And that is going to pervade these products that we have not associated with digital technology, like food, energy, buildings, clothes.
I had I was advising and counseling a bunch of entrepreneurs who are just finishing college and in grad school. They're trying to figure out what to go do next and where would I go, where should you go start a company. And I was making the point to them, and I'm wondering on your feedback here, that we're, you know, this notion that we're about to have 4 billion new consumers, 4.2 billion new consumers coming online in the next decade. And these 4.2 billion people around the world are coming on at, you know, 100 megabit, gigabit connection speeds, but they're going to want everything we want, but they're not going to go to a bank branch, they're not going to go to an insurance broker, they're not going to go to a doctor, they're not going to go to a school. So it's like, can you build products and services that are completely dematerialized for those 4 billion people?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've talked about this a lot, and this is affecting every industry. So it's not like you have to work in a traditionally high-tech industry to, A, take advantage of these digital revolutions or engage in disruptive change. It's affecting everything. All these traditional industries are becoming information technologies.
Yeah.
And it's going to be worldwide. I mean, it already is. 4 billion people's half the planet as it is.
Pretty good.
That can't continue to grow exponentially. So biology is pretty slow. But, I mean, we're already far more powerful just because our tools are so powerful, and that's going to continue to accelerate.
Let me ask you a provocative question. One of the things we have a lot of sort of, I use the moniker dangerous ideas here. And I'm generally curious about this because we haven't had this conversation about how these exponential technologies are going to impact the nation state. Because you've said this eloquently, and I said it and agree, you know, we've got this continuous exponential growth that's almost unstoppable, but we have these factors in society like government. People like waking up in the morning and realizing the world hasn't changed from the night before. We don't like change inherently as humans. But religious institutions and government institutions try and stabilize things. So is the nation state that as we know it today going to be around 20, 30, 40 years from now? What are your thoughts, sir?
Well, mechanical typewriters are still around.
Yeah.
Horses and buggies are still around.
Just not very used.
Right. So these institutions stick around, but they change their role in our lives. They already have. The nation state is not as profound as it was. Religion used to direct every aspect of your life, minute to minute. It's still important in some ways, but it's much less important, much less pervasive, plays a much smaller role in most people's lives than it did. And the same is true for governments. And we are fantastically interconnected already. There's some issue with the pension funds in Spain, and you know the economies all over the world feel it, but also react to it and absorb it. Nation states are not islands anymore. They used to be that way much more so. So we're already much more of a global community. The generation growing up today really feel like world citizens much more than ever before, because they're talking to people all over the world, and it's not a novelty. I mean, they've grown up that way. So that, you know, we watch news on CNN and so on, and it focuses us on certain issues, and yes, they're important, but the kind of disruptive change that both of us talk about is what is really important.
You and I are lucky. I live at XPRIZE and at SU. You're here at Google, and there's a everything is possible abundance mindset that people have here. And did you have that growing up? Did you have that as an entrepreneur? When did you get that? Because I think that's a really critical part of being a successful entrepreneur, having that mindset of abundance.
I think I did get that from my family. They were profoundly optimistic and felt that any problem can be overcome. My grandfather was particularly proud of having escaped with his whole family intact from Hitler, and that was a pretty big challenge. And that continued, that all these different problems could be solved. And I began being an entrepreneur pretty early. I mean, I got involved with my own computer projects as a teenager. I became the software engineer for Head Start at 14 and started a business at 18, which was successful.
Not too shabby, pal. So,
well, my point is that, yes, I had an optimistic and entrepreneurial attitude, and it did come from my family. My great-grandmother, as I've mentioned before, started a school in 1868. And that was an enterprise, and it was socially disruptive. It was the first school to provide a higher education for girls, went from K to 14th grade, and it was very controversial. Like, what is the point of educating girls to that degree? And it really revolutionized women's education. So disruption and the value of education and knowledge and optimism about the future really came from my family.
Yeah, I found that when I wrote my last book, Bold, when I had interviewed Jeff Bezos and Larry Page and Elon and Richard Branson, one of the attributes they all share, and I found it with almost all great world-changing entrepreneurs, is a sense of optimism and abundance. And I think that's partly why, you know, I think to be a great entrepreneur, you need to have that positive mindset and not let the crisis news network get you down. Another thing I think that's important, I'm curious if it impacted your life, I know it was mine, is having a community around you that is supportive in helping you. Because if you're an entrepreneur someplace and you have a crazy idea, and I remind people the day before something is really a breakthrough, it's a crazy idea, if you have people shooting you down and telling you that's terrible, it's really hard to break out. And so I know I had a very supportive, when I was at MIT and within my own organizations, I had this very dreamy, anything is possible community supporting me that allowed me to build, to dream bigger. Did you have that?
Well, I agree that's important, and I've gained that over time. I started a little bit earlier than you did, and there wasn't much of an entrepreneurial community. When I started my first major business, which developed the reading machine and flatbed scanner and speech synthesis and so on, 1974, the total amount of high-tech venture capital in the United States was $10 million.
Mostly in Boston, right? I mean, it was early on.
But $10 million, I mean,
that's nothing.
That's a small deal today.
Yeah, that's not even a seed round.
So, in fact, I raised seed capital, so I had some support. That phrase did not exist, but, you know, basically friends and family. So that's part of being an entrepreneur, is going out on a limb and risking not only your own well-being, but the resources of your loved ones. There wasn't much of an entrepreneurial community. Venture capital really didn't exist, and these terms didn't exist, and there was no entrepreneurial community, and the whole idea of the spirit of entrepreneurship barely existed. I remember 1968, MIT started a program called USP, Undergraduate Special Program. It was the first program at MIT to support entrepreneurship, and I was one of the flagship members of that. You basically, your entire educational program then was starting a business. So I started a business matching up high school students to colleges. But that was the beginning of entrepreneurship, and it was a radically new concept. So it was, I'd say by the 1980s, it became a kind of established thing, but it was not a concept that anybody recognized in the 60s.
I'm curious about another, one of the things that we talk about at Singularity University a lot for the graduate studies, the Global Solutions Program, and that I speak a lot about in Abundance Digital, is having a massively transformative purpose, you know, something that drives you. I'm just curious, what, you know, you've had a number of them, and you can have more than one as a person, but how would you describe your MTP, Ray, and when did that originate for you?
Well, my father had a major heart attack when I was 15. He then died when I was 22. So I began to be interested in health. I was concerned about him, and then I was responding to his loss. But I also then recognized I probably inherited his disposition to heart disease, and as it turned out, type 2 diabetes. So at that point, I put it on my long-term to-do list to overcome heart disease and death, and really had that idea.
You slipped in there and death,
yeah.
Which I share with Ray.
Well, I mean, death and the fear of death and how to deal with this profoundly antagonizing concept, everything we believe in, has animated human history.
Yeah,
we've come up with theories and ideas about it. Rationalize, oh, that tragic thing, you know, that's actually a liberation. It's a good thing. The purpose of life is to embrace death, which is a rationalization, because our first reaction to hearing someone died is that, oh, that we don't rejoice, depending on maybe who it is, but...
let's not go there.
But we've rationalized that tragedy. So in fact, I had that idea really when earlier, like at 10.
Is that true?
I had articulated, you know, we don't really have to die, and we should extend human life dramatically. It was kind of a vague idea at 10. It became more formal when I realized that I had, you know, a genetic disposition to deal with. It was on my long-term to-do list.
Yeah.
About a decade later, mid-30s, I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and I said, okay, I need to bump up the priority of this. And then I really delved into it. I wrote my first health book, and I'd say in the...
This is the 10% diet?
Yeah.
So, which is a great book, by the way.
In the 80s, and it really became a major theme, overcoming death. And it's closely related to artificial intelligence in terms of enhancing who we are, physically, biologically, and mentally, intellectually, creatively. It's all kind of part of the same cloth.
So if I may, you know, again, what the themes for me that drive a great entrepreneur is, you know, an abundance mindset, having a great community, having an MTP that emotionally drives you, and obviously the connection to your dad's early passing and the what that brings up in you drove that emotion, and then having that drive a moonshot, right? And you've been involved in a number of moonshots. You and I share a moonshot. My earliest MTP was space, that drove a lot of the space stuff I'm doing. But then lately, I've caught up with you in the last decade with a focus on an MTP of extending the healthy human lifespan. Uh-huh. And a few moonshots there. Let's talk about sort of the moonshots in extending the lifespan. I'm assuming that you guys are all interested in adding 30 to 40 healthy years. But what do you think is possible in terms of extension?
Well, at least our viewers who still have a version 1.0 biological body.
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, we can't actually know that for a fact.
Well, version 2 is still in, not beta yet, but we're close.
Especially here at the hallowed halls of Google. I love the Time magazine, Google Cheats Death. And at the same time that I was starting Human Longevity with Craig Venter, of which you're an advisor, you and Bill Maris and others were advising Larry and Sergey and the team here on creating Calico, which is an Alphabet company.
Yeah. I mean, Calico's been pretty quiet. What little I know about it, I really can't share, but...
Oh, come on, no one's listening.
But it is one of many examples of the increasing interest in Bridge 2, which is reprogramming the outdated software of life. It's not a metaphor to say that biology is software. Our genes are strings of data, but it evolved when conditions were very different. And it was not in the interests of humans to live more than in their 20s.
Yeah.
At that point, evolution was not on your side because you're using up the food and resources of the tribe, and it's better that you not live. There's a small exception to that called the grandma hypothesis that it was beneficial to human development that there be some grandparents who could then share their wisdom and help the evolution of technology and culture. But a few grandmas would do.
If I could expand on this, just I've always wondered, and if you do the math, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago, when you went into puberty age 13, you'd have a baby. I mean, literally at that point. Then by the time you were 26, your baby's having a baby, you're a grandparent.
By the time you're 26, you're probably dead. I mean, life expectancy was 19 a thousand years ago.
All right. Well, the fact is, the older you got, before there was McDonald's and Whole Foods, if you were taking food out of the mouths of your children or their grandchildren, you never passed the genes along. So the best thing you could do is give your bits back to the environment.
Yeah, and evolution did not favor long life. And so, for example, our immune system, which is great, you wouldn't last long without it, does not recognize cancers and thinks, oh, that's me, because that's something that happens later on in life. So biotechnology is to reprogram biology. Of life. I mean, that's what HLI is trying to do.
Yeah.
But it's a major movement. It's the cutting edge of medicine. It was enabled by Craig Venter's little project to sequence the genome. These technologies have been doubling in power every year. They're now 10,000 times more powerful than when the genome was sequenced in 2003. And we're beginning now to get clinical impact. We can now fix a broken heart from a heart attack. We can grow organs.
We can edit a genome and fix a genetic disease.
I mean, at United Therapeutics, we're growing organs, ultimately with the patient's own DNA, installing them successfully in pigs, which are actually pretty close to humans, coming to a human near you soon. But we're going to basically completely redefine the health and medicine. Health and medicine has not been an information technology up until just recently. I mean, yes, we use computers to keep patient records. Actually, we don't even do that very well, and to organize the information. But fundamentally, it's been hit or miss. We just kind of find certain chemicals that have a beneficial impact. We're now actually reprogramming biology, understanding, designing interventions based on the reverse engineering of human biology. And that's an exponential process, and that is now entering clinical impacts right at the cutting edge, like the ability to reprogram adult stem cells and rejuvenate a damaged heart, which half of all heart attack survivors have. If you're an American, you've got to go be a medical tourist. It'll be approved soon.
And, of course, Celularity, which is my latest company, which United Therapeutics, which you're on the board of, is the largest investor in. There's a whole movement towards, you know, making aging a disease and not an inevitability.
So, I mean, but that is the cutting edge of all of medicine. Yeah. It's a trickle today of of actual clinical applications, it's going to be a flood over the next decade. All the statistics on life insurance and health insurance and figuring out whether Social Security will be solvent in 20 years are based on models of the continued linear progress of health and medicine. And I've talked to people who are involved in setting, for example, life insurance rates, and say, oh, well, we take into consideration medical progress using a model that's come from the linear progression of health and medicine, as if completely ignoring this transformation.
If you're looking for an industry to disrupt, insurance is going to be disrupted so many ways to Friday, it's not funny, between blockchain, autonomous cars, extended human lifespan.
And getting accurate models of health and medicine.
Yeah, I mean, all of this stuff. How old are you targeting to live, Ray? Do you have a target number?
Yes, I would like... Well, first of all,
I'll tell you mine if you tell me yours.
I'd like to live to tomorrow.
Yes, we can help that.
So that's a start. I feel that I will always feel that way. So I took the people and said, I don't want to live past 90 or 95. Then I talked to 95-year-olds, and they, in fact, want to live to tomorrow and next year. And my other goal then is to live past longevity escape velocity.
What does that mean?
So that means that we're adding more time than is going by, not just to infant life expectancy, but to your remaining life expectancy. Now, life expectancy is at any point in time is a statistical phenomena. You could have a computed life expectancy based on today's technology of whatever, 50 years, still be hit by the proverbial bus tomorrow. We're working on that too, particularly here with self-driving cars.
Yes.
But, you know, and I talk about three, it's actually four bridges to radical life extension, each of which attacks the phenomena that cut our lives short. In my view, it's not death that gives life meaning, although I've had this debate with people. It's what you can do with life, be creative, have relationships, love people, be funny, create music, and that's going to be enhanced. So when we talk about living hundreds of years, people envision being a quintessential 95-year-old living hundreds of years, and that's not what we're talking about. We're not even talking about being a 25-year-old and living hundreds of years, but profoundly enhancing who we are. I think it would be profoundly actually disturbing, and we'd suffer from a deep ennui, that's a cool French word, if we had radical life extension without radical life expansion.
Yeah.
But we're going to merge with AI. We can talk about that.
We will.
We're going to become smarter. We're going to add to the hierarchy of the neocortex, and we're going to create things that we can't even envision now, the way we did the last time we got more neocortex, when we became humanoids, and we invented language and music and
humor. Two million years ago.
Tried explaining music to a primate.
And Let me expand on what Ray just said here on this idea of longevity escape velocity. So science is continually extending the human lifespan, helping us cure heart disease, cancer, eventually neurodegenerative disease. And so there's a point at which for every year that you're alive, science is extending your life for more than a year. And there, it's a mechanism of living long enough to live forever, to coin your phrase. What's your prediction of when we're going to hit longevity escape velocity?
So I think we'll actually hit it before we can prove that we've hit it.
Okay.
I think I've hit it myself. I think my life expectancy is not getting shorter. It's actually getting longer. Reason for that is that I'm very aggressive in adopting sort of cutting-edge ideas and keeping track of my own situation and being proactive.
But for the general public, what do you think? What's the number? I've heard you quote a number.
I think it's only 10-12 years away.
So let me just translate that, right?
Because at that point, biotechnology is going to have taken over medicine. It's just beginning. The next decade is going to be a profound revolution.
It's bio and AI together.
And that's, yeah. Well, I mean, AI helps biotechnology, but it's fundamentally biotechnology. And that's just Bridge 2.
Yep.
That'll bring us to Bridge 3, which is nanorobots that can basically finish the job of the immune system.
So, you know, your job here is don't do something stupid over the next 15 years.
Yeah, wear your seatbelt till we get the self-driving cars going.
And then the other question is, if you're an entrepreneur, and I think about this a lot, right, if all of a sudden people are beginning to live longer and longer and longer, which they will, and we have this age wave right now, but what are the business opportunities as life begins to extend? I think about that as I'm looking at businesses.
That doesn't necessarily mean providing products for what we now think of as elderly people, because we're going to become less elderly in terms of the stereotypical view of what that means.
Yeah, it's healthy aging. Yeah. So I've got
I think aging will just mean getting wiser, because we'll have more experience.
By the way, it's going to be a huge economic boom to countries, because imagine instead of retiring at age 65, you stay in the workforce and continue to generate revenue at the top of your game, right? So if you're at retirement age, consider not retiring. I think one of the most amazing correlations is when you retire, your death rate for retirees is super high.
Well, people actually do get sick very often when they retire, because they kind of lost their purpose. The whole idea of retirement implies that you don't like what you're doing and you're very eager to do something else that maybe something you have a passion for that you've always wanted to do. Why not do that in the first place? And I think the kind of economic situation we're entering is that's actually the best economic strategy is to do something you have a passion for in the first place.
Which goes back to your MTP, right? What's your massively transformative purpose? What's driven you as a child? What's excited you? And then how do you take on a moonshot that is hard that you can work on over a decade, right? I mean, my moonshots in space and longevity and abundance are decadal, and yours
are. There could be many ways of doing that.
Yeah.
My father had a talent for music. He was a genius at that and knew that when he was 5. And so his musical creations was his transformative purpose.
Sure.
Some people are good at understanding the psychology of other people and creating organizations or helping people with their relationships, being a counselor or a therapist. I mean, there's many different ways that you can contribute. Some people discover their passion young as a child. Some people takes longer. I think that's the purpose of education now, is really to help people discover what they have a passion for, which means experiencing the world and the different kinds of purposes you can have.
We have a ton of questions from this amazing community. Thank you guys for the questions you sent in advance and the questions that you're working with AJ, who's sitting right next to us gathering. First question I have here from Steve is, when do you think we're going to see an AI like Jarvis? In Iron Man, Jarvis is sort of a personal AI that helps you interpret information, interface with the world. Where are we now, and how fast will we get to something Jarvis-like?
Well, another example of Jarvis was Samantha and Her.
Yep, which was a great movie, a non-dystopian movie for the first time. Thank you, Hollywood.
Well, yeah, it was a futuristic movie that I thought was somewhat consistent with my ideas, because not only was it not dystopian, but it wasn't this one AI versus a brave band of humans for control of the world. It wasn't one AI. Everybody had their OS, and it was smart enough for you to fall in love with and have a relationship with. So, I mean, that's an articulation of human-level AI, which I've been very consistent at putting it 2029. So, actually, in a book I wrote in 1989, Age of Intelligent Machines...
2029 is 11 years from now.
No, it's 12.
Well, we're about at 2018, so... If it's going to be available in 2029, it'll be in beta in 2028.
Well, things are going to be moving quickly. So it's December of 2029. But So I bounded it, I said, from early 2000s to late 2030s in the age of intelligent machines, which I wrote in the 80s. Actually, it took longer to write a book in those days. My most important information technology was a roll of quarters that I could use to feed the copier in the library. Really, because, I mean, that's...
That's how you did your research, huh?
You went to a library, and you'd find some pages, and you had to copy them.
If you were lucky enough to find the pages.
Right. I mean, that was a skill. So, 1999, I said 2029, Age of Spiritual Machines.
That's amazing.
So that was very controversial. Stanford held a conference on my prediction, and they took a poll. There are no instant polling devices, so it was by hand, but... the consensus of AI experts was hundreds of years, if ever. I'd say 25% said it would never happen. Mm. 2006, there was a conference, AI 50, at Dartmouth to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the 1956 Dartmouth conference that gave AI its name, by my mentor Marvin Minsky and John McCarthy. And the consensus, then we had instant polling devices, and consensus was 50 years. Polls now are the median is 20 to 30 years. There's a growing group of people who think I'm too conservative. That's looking quite sound to me. I mean, it's looking more and more comfortable. Like, I see what we can do already. We have computers that do a pretty good job of understanding the meaning of natural language. A
friend of mine's company called Viv was just acquired by Samsung. They've done, these are from the founders of Siri, they've done an amazing job, and it's the age of the personal assistant, they call it. So 2029 for Jarvis-like interface.
I mean, they're getting better at a fantastic pace. Yeah. I mean, in a matter of months, the systems that I see and experience and work with are getting rapidly better. So 2029 is going to be about right.
And you're inside the rabbit hole here at Google. My question to you guys is what does that make you think about, right? I mean, if you've got Jarvis level to put a mental mindset in place of that can answer questions, help gather data for you, project the data for you, help you analyze the data. I mean, it becomes pretty incredible what the average person can start to think about and do.
I mean, my view, there's a lot of discussion about AI versus humans, and there's a long history of dystopian futurist movies along those lines. But in my view, it's part of who we are. I mean, we are the technology creating species, and we've always done that to extend our reach.
Yeah.
So we created a tool that allowed us to reach food at that higher branch. We created tools that allowed us to build structures that we couldn't build with our bare hands. I mean, who here could build a skyscraper? But we leverage our muscles. And now we've leveraged our minds, so we can access all of human knowledge, and not just access the knowledge, but we have all these AI assistants that help us find the knowledge.
And it's democratized and leveled the playing field, where I like to say access to Google for the poorest child in Africa and access to Google for Larry Page is the same.
Right.
It's amazing.
Exactly.
I'm just having him confirm for me that Larry Page and that kid in Africa have the same access to Google.
They do. and the bandwidth is getting pretty comparable.
Who's going to lose when that happens?
So it is democratized. And we completely ignore that in our economic statistics. That's another whole issue. But these are brain extenders today. We're going to literally put them inside our bodies and brains. I think that's somewhat of an arbitrary distinction. So even if it's on my belt or in my pocket, it is a brain extender.
Yeah.
It really feels that way. I mean, and people really think of it that way. They can't leave their cell phone, smartphone at home, because it is part of their mind. Yeah.
I do a poll when I go out and speak, and right now I probably have done this to 20,000 people and asked, does anybody in the room not have their cell phone with them? I've had one hand go up. One hand. And it's extraordinary because, you know, you move more than a meter from this thing and you're like, you get nervous. There's a right. connection. So let's talk about the next step, which is connecting the neocortex with the cloud. We've talked about this a lot. You and I have a mutual friend, Brian Johnson, who's the CEO of Kernel. Brian's going to be on stage with you at Abundance 360, going deep into brain-computer interface. Elon's working on it with Neuralace, Advanced Micro Devices. Facebook's working on it. I'm sure someplace within the kilometer here it's going on. Talk about BCI here. You made a concrete prediction of when we're going to have it, but what does that mean?
Right. Well, the projects you mentioned now, I think, will be usable for specific overcoming profound deficits, cognitive deficits, paralysis, enabling people to communicate who are profoundly disabled. What I'm talking about, and these are precursor technologies to what I'm talking about.
These are the transistors.
But the neocortex, to back up, the world is hierarchical. Trees have trunks, which have branches, which have more branches, which have leaves. It's a hierarchical structure of the world. So evolution said, gee, it'd be useful to have a brain structure that could understand hierarchies. And it invented the neocortex 200 million years ago.
You write about this in How to Create a Mind.
Yeah. And so it enabled these early mammals to actually invent new behaviors. Non-mammalian animals without a neocortex have fixed behaviors. They could evolve a new fixed behavior over, 10,000 generations. And that was good enough, actually, 200 million years ago, because the environment changed very slowly. But then there was a sudden change 65 million years ago. If you look at the rock structures representing 65 million years ago, the geologists will explain that shows a catastrophic change to the environment.
An increased rate layer of iridium that shows us a metallic chondrite hit the Earth.
That's the leading hypothesis. The volcanic
super volcanoes
action crowd has not completely given in yet. But anyway, something happened, and that's when mammals overtook their ecological niche. And now they got bigger, their brains got bigger even faster, and the neocortex got bigger even faster, and that developed these curvatures and ridges that are distinctive of a primate brain. And then 2 million years ago, if you remember,
it's been a while, but I remember, yeah.
We were walking around and we didn't have these big foreheads. And so evolution said, neocortex is pretty good stuff. Let's have even more and developed a larger enclosure, all of which provided for more neocortex.
By the way, limited by the pelvis as a constraint for the size of the brain.
Right. Well, the brain couldn't get any bigger because birth would have been impossible.
Yeah.
So there probably were some really smart humanoids then, but they couldn't pass on their genes. The fact that this was additional neocortex has been controversial. I wrote about that actually 50 years ago, but and there was one neuroscientist that confirmed that through autopsies. But at any rate, it is additional neocortex. So what did we do with it? We put it at the top of the hierarchy. The neocortex is organized in a hierarchy. It's not one big neural net. So this is where my thesis on how the brain works differs from just the normal sort of big neural net in the connectionist field. It's lots of different modules, each of which is a small neural net, can learn a pattern, remember it, recognize it, but they're organized in a hierarchy. And recently, the European Brain Reverse Engineering Project has confirmed that there is this repeating module of about 100 neurons, repeated 300 million times. These are the modules in the neocortex. There's no plasticity within your lifetime. It doesn't change within the module, but the connections between the modules are changing. And we can see in a module axons coming in from other modules, showing a hierarchy. And the hierarchy is created by our own thinking. And as you go up the hierarchy, things get more interesting and more intelligent. the very bottom of the hierarchy, I can tell that that's a curved line. I can tell that that's a straight line. At the top of the hierarchy, I can tell that that's funny, that's ironic, she's pretty. So what we did with it, since we were already doing a great job of being primates, we put it at the top of the neocortical hierarchy. And that was the enabling factor for us to invent language and music. No other primate has music. Every human culture we've ever discovered has music, humor, technology. That also needed this opposable appendage, but in terms of brain activity, that was the enabling factor. It was a one-shot deal, because as we just said, the brain could not continue to grow in size, but it was enough to just put us over that threshold, where we could then create technology that would enhance us further. So we're going to do it again. What I'm doing here, what I've actually been doing for quite a while, is creating...
Here at Google, in the words, what Larry brought you in for.
Is to create AI based on my model of the neocortex. And I'm not saying we have perfect knowledge of the neocortex yet. We're getting better and better models as we get more information from the Brain Reverse Engineering Project. By the 2030s, we'll have really neocortex that's as good or better than our current neocortex, but it'll be bigger, and we'll be able to connect our neocortex wirelessly to the cloud, just the way your smartphone, that smartphone is billions of times more powerful per dollar than the computer I used at MIT, but that's not the most interesting thing. It makes itself thousands, millions of times more powerful yet by connecting to millions of computers in the cloud. We can't yet do that with our brains. We do actually expand our brains indirectly through these devices, but we'll do it directly from our neocortex, and not just to do the things we do with our smartphones, like search and translation directly from our brains, although that'll be feasible and useful, but to actually connect to more neocortex. So just like we did 2 million years ago, we're going to expand our neocortex. And just like we did 2 million years ago, we'll put it at the top of the neocortical hierarchy. And just as we did then, we'll create whole new concepts and ways of communicating that we can't even understand without that additional neocortex. So, I mean, primates who don't have that additional neocortex can't understand music or language or humor. So we'll create things of that profound nature. We'll become smarter, we'll become funnier. The only difference is that unlike 2 million years ago, it won't be a one-shot deal because the cloud is doubling in power as we speak and will continue to grow exponentially.
Eric asks, where on the